This is the Podcast Inc. production. Booyah!
And now, this is the moment podcasting fans listening around the world have been waiting for. Coming to you, not so live, from a listening device of your choice, it's time! Podcasting out of this corner, a mixed martial talker, holding no professional record, he stands at 6 feet 1 1/2 inches tall, weighing in at whatever he feels like, hailing out of Toronto, Ontario, Canada, presenting the sometimes angry, always funny, self-proclaimed podcasting champion of the world, Steve Fingerstyles.
So, welcome to another rendition of the podcast. I am here once again, always again, and joined by a 20-year video game industry veteran who's worked on over 40 games that you've most likely played. He is a fellow Torontonian coming to us today, all the way from Japan, Andrew Alfonso.
Hey, nice to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you, my friend. Thank you very much. Again, working on 40 games. You are also a wrestling fan. You are also from Toronto. So we're going to have a lot of stuff to talk about throughout the show and all that fun stuff. But before we get to Japan, before we get to wrestling, I want to touch on your bread and butter, the video game industry. When did you fall in love with video games and become a fan? What was like your first memories of playing video games?
Oh, man, I think probably like, you know, when I was growing up in Toronto, around like when I was 6 years old, I begged my dad to get an NES. I wanted to get the Super Nintendo Duck Hunt, combination. I was begging for it, crying, and I finally got it after like, you know, five months of begging. And I just fell in love with it ever since then. So I had my Nintendo, grew up with Nintendo, Super Nintendo, PlayStation, all those original games. Now that I'm older, have my own money, I just pretty much buy whatever games I want to. Don't have to go begging or crying for it anymore. So yeah, I've been a fan ever since I was born, you know, ever since I was little.
That's awesome to hear. So when did you think that you could do this for a living? When did that first thought come into your head? You're like, hey, I could do this.
It was kind of funny, actually. When I was like 19, I got a freelance job writing for a website, and then they paid for my flight to go to E3 that year, 1999.
Nice.
And I'm a big fighting game fan. I love Street Fighter. Okay. I love Soul Calibur and all those games. And I was playing Soul Calibur like crazy because I imported the Dreamcast from Japan.
Nice.
I was like, that's hardcore. I had the money. I was like, oh, I'm going to do this. And so I got the Japanese Dreamcast and Soul Calibur. And then at E3 the next year, they had a Soul Calibur tournament. And I won the tournament. And then a bunch of guys from EGM, IGN, all the gaming magazines were there trying to win the tournament, but I won. So then IGN kind of, started talking to me on the side after tournaments, like, you're pretty good. Do you want to start writing for us? You can start writing strategy guides or something like that. And I was like, sure, let's do that.
Nice.
And then, you know, that kind of evolved. I moved to Japan like about 5 years after that. And I, you know, pitched them up the idea, let me write about Japan, about Japanese games, Japanese culture and stuff like that. And they said, okay, sure. So I started doing that for like a couple of years. And then that led to actually, my current job right now. So it all just kind of sinked. I never really thought like, okay, you know, I really want to get into the game industry. It just kind of happened, you know, just by just circumstance of, you know, stuff that I was doing on the side, just because I love playing games and all that. So yeah, it's kind of, I'm actually very lucky to be in the position I am right now.
So are you self-taught or did you go to actual school to learn any of the techniques to make video games?
No, I'm completely self-taught because, you know, basically what I'm doing is I'm working on localization in Japan. So I translate from Japanese to English.
Oh, beautiful.
And I also do like, you know, a couple, some scripting and all that stuff. But, you know, learning Japanese, I never learned Japanese when I was a kid. I learned it when I moved to Japan.
Okay.
That was entirely self-taught. And even all the scripting and stuff like that, I just got a couple books from the bookstore, started learning myself, doing some exercises. I took some online courses, tutorials and stuff like that. And I just kind of went through it myself. So everything is kind of like self-taught. So because of that, you know, I guess sometimes, you know, there's some things that I might be missing, basic stuff that I might be missing, sure. But you know, it's all right. I'm still making it, you know, it's all good.
So now that you've been in the industry for so long, and you've also been a fan before you got in, obviously, what's a game that you've played in the past that you wish you helped work on or be a part of?
My favorite game, you might know this game also, okay. Super Nintendo, Chrono Trigger. That's my number one RPG, my number one game of all time.
Really?
Okay. It's just such a fantastic game. It's just like, you know, you're just going all over the place. You're going through, like, you know, all these different time periods with your party. You're facing all off against all these awesome looking monsters and stuff like that, and it just doesn't stop. I wish I was, you know, born in the 70s or the 60s so I could, like, move to Japan and just start working on that. That would have been amazing, you know?
No, that's so cool to hear, because, yeah, that is one of the OGs alongside pretty much Final Fantasy VI is up there too, and obviously Zelda on the SNES. The problem with me was I didn't get to play Chrono Trigger right away. I played I played Zelda first, A Link to the Past. That's what made me hook, because I used to hate RPGs on the regular NES, because it was more script. It wasn't like, I didn't find it fun. Like, I was more into beat 'em ups back then. And then the SNES came and it was like open world RPG sort of, and it was like, oh, this I could get into. So Zelda, hook, line, and sinker got me in. And then Final Fantasy VI just blew my mind with the whole story and everything behind it. So when I got to Chrono Trigger, I think I was already RPG'd out, if that makes sense. So I don't think I appreciate it as much as everyone else, like how you do.
I totally understand that. Like, I got into RPGs with Dragon Warrior on the NES.
Oh, I hated that game. I'm so sorry.
I had to beg my dad again, because they had, you know, Nintendo Power Magazine, right, in the States, in North America.
Right.
And they were offering a free game with it. And I'm like, Dad, you got to get me this.
Yeah.
Come on, Dragon Warrior, you get a free game and the magazine. So I begged him for like a month. He got it for me. I got Dragon Warrior 1.
Yeah.
I just beat the crap out of that for like months and months. I loved it. And I couldn't find another game that was similar like that until like the next Dragon Quest games came out. But then Super Nintendo hit, I saw Final Fantasy IV.
Okay.
And I loved that game. That was amazing. Then Final Fantasy VI hit after that. That was amazing. And then Chrono Trigger. So it was like just bam, bam, bam.
It was.
One after another of just like quality RPGs. It was amazing.
And it's actually funny that we talk about that, because recently, even this past year alone, in 2023, we had the likes of Sea of Stars and Octopath Traveler 2. And I played Sea of Stars first, loved it. Then I played Octopath Traveler. I was like, oh, man. I think, again, I'm RPG'd out, because these RPGs aren't like back in the day where it was like 20 hours, 30 hours. Now it's like 40, 60 hours if you want to do everything properly. So to put in back-to-back like that in the same, it's hard. And I understand, as, again, people who design games and put games out and stuff, that you can't really wait for someone else to drop something and you go on your own schedule, obviously, right? But wouldn't it be beautiful in a perfect world to have these big, massive games drop like a month apart from each other instead of all in the same month?
Yeah, well, I don't even know if a month is enough, because, you know, this year, man, even this year you had like Persona 3, you had, you know, like a Dragon, now you're going to have like Dragon's Dogma, and you have some other games coming out, and they're all like the same month or month apart, and it's just like, I'm like 44, I'm also 44, right? So,
nice. You
know, I don't have time for this stuff.
Right?
even a month is like not enough. Like, I need 2 or 3 months to get through all these games, and like even then I'm not getting the full, like, you know, 100% completion. I'm just doing the main quest storyline and just going through that and just getting like the bare minimum. So yeah, I mean, Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of games coming out. I feel there are like more quality games coming out now than there were, like, you know, when we were kids.
Yeah,
like you always count on, like, you know, Nintendo and Square back in the day. But those are like kind of tentpole titles that came out. You could just play them for a year and be happy. But now, like, everything is like quality. It's a first world problem for sure, you know?
No, it's so true. Well, speaking of upcoming games, I think not this year, the next year, 2025, is even more stacked because you have games like GTA 6, Wolverine, the new Marvel game just got announced. And it's like, oh my God. Yeah. It's like, again, I'm trying to catch up. Whereas now I'm going to fall all behind again and I'm going to have to miss on stuff. And it's like, I don't want to miss because I'm a fan too.
Yeah, exactly. I totally get it. It's like 2023 was crazy. 2024 looking even crazier. 2025 is going to be insane because you're going to have you're going to have GTA 6, you're going to have Monster Hunter, you're going to have, the new Marvel game that just got announced. And it's like already, we don't even know when these games are going to be released, but you already know, like, oh my God, there's like 3 to 4 like bangers already coming out. And, you know, you're going to have to plan for it. It's just insane.
And then the so-called Switch 2, most likely in 2025, if not announced by then, should drop too. And it's like, oh man, what am I going to do?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of funny. Like now, like, you know, before when I was a kid and I was begging my parents to buy me these games,
right?
It was a matter of money, right? Yeah. Like, I didn't have the money because I was a kid. I didn't have a job. Now that I have the money, it's a matter of time.
Right.
That's the issue, right? It's just like, I don't have the time anymore to do this. You know, I could, you know, just veg out. Like, actually, that's why I'm on the podcast today, because I took a day off today just to play games, right?
Nice.
That's I had a dentist appointment at 9 o'clock, finished at 10, do this podcast, and until 6 p.m., I'm free, so I'm just going to do 6 hours of games, and that's it. Oh, and, you know, sweet. But I have to actually take the day off. I don't have, like, you know, I can't do this all the time.
So what type of gamer are you? Do you play a bunch of games at once, or do you play one game from start to finish and move on to the next?
I always want to play one game.
Okay.
Just I'm through and then, start the next one. But it's a lot tougher now because there's my taste in games is just very diverse, and I'm playing a lot of those online games. I'm playing the single player games. Mm-hmm. So like I'm playing Helldivers 2, which I've played since launch.
Nice.
And that's an online game, right?
Right.
It's amazing. It's so much fun. It doesn't require a lot of commitment, but you know, you want to play like an hour or so every day.
Okay.
Just to, you know, keep up with everyone because you're playing with your friends.
Right.
And you don't want to, you know, lag behind them. But then I'm playing like a single player game like a Dragon or you know, a Persona or something like that, which is a single player game. RPG takes 100 hours. So you want to get in like maybe 2 hours a day just to, you know, finish that in a reasonable amount of time. So now you got to choose like, okay, do I play the online game or do I play a single player game? So I got to keep, you know, logging onto my PlayStation, check if my friends are online. They're not online. Okay, I'm playing a single player game.
Gotcha.
Then as soon as they get online, like, oh, okay, maybe I should stop now and switch over to the online game. It's just like, it's tough. Again, first world problems.
It's so true. How about on the go gaming? Do you have like a Switch or anything, a Rogue or whatnot that you take on the go that could help you cram in a few hours here and there?
I got a Switch, but I mainly play the Switch at home. I play it like when my wife and my daughter, when they're watching TV, that's when I play my Switch.
Gotcha.
And so I'm playing games that have require a little bit less commitment. So I'm playing like Dave the Diver, which is like an awesome game,
right.
Really, really fun to play. But you don't really need to, like, you know, spend too much time dedicated on that. I'm playing some of the retro games, like, you know, they have the on the Switch, they have like the Super Nintendo, you know,
yeah, that's games. The best.
So I can just, you know, play that for like, you know, 20-30 minutes,
sure,
while they're watching TV, and then once they're off, I could just switch back to my PlayStation or something. So you know, I got a whole variety of stuff games going on, you know.
Nice. Well, and speaking of retro games, if you want to get some retro games and you want to support the show, go visit First Row Collectibles at firstrow.ca. Use promo code THEPODCAST20 to receive 20% off. Like I said, they have a ton of retro games there. Old comic books, new comic books, sports memorabilia, signed wrestling memorabilia. Anything you want, it is there. Best thing is they ship worldwide. Even better, they update daily. So please visit them at firstrow.ca. And if you're into video games and books, please visit bossfightbooks.com for great books on classic video games. You'll find titles like Mega Man 3, GoldenEye 007, World of Warcraft, and so many others. Everything you see on their website's available in paperback and ebook format, so please check them out at bossfightbooks.com. And if you want to support me directly, you can visit my merchandise store at tpublic.com or scroll down on today's advice and submit it right there in that description. Click on the link, takes you right to the merchandise store. I got everything from hoodies to travel mugs, phone cases, anything you need or want, it is there. But the easiest thing, the best thing to do to support the show is rate, subscribe, review on all major platforms, most specifically Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. All right, Andrew, you said it. You grew up in Toronto, you moved to Japan. So how many years have you been in Japan actually now? I know you said it, you moved from 19... When 5 years after that, so 24-ish? So how long? So 20 yes, years?
Exactly, 24. Yep, 24. So I mentioned, yeah, I moved from 24. I'm 44 now, so this June is going to be my 20th year in Japan.
Wow, that's crazy. So what was the hardest thing about moving to Japan when you first got there?
There's two things. They're both food-related.
Oh, okay.
One, the lack, there's no sweet and sour sauce in a McDonald's in Japan.
Really?
Blew my fucking mind. I'm just like, I went to McDonald's and I'm like, okay, I want some chicken nuggets. And they're like, okay, well, we have barbecue and mustard. I'm like, what's mustard? Do you have sweet and sour? Like, what's sweet and sour? I'm like, oh my God, okay.
Oh no.
This is a problem. And I had to like ask some of my cousins who were coming visiting me. I'm like, okay, I want you to go to McDonald's and I want you to buy like 10 packets of sweet and sour sauce.
That's hilarious.
Because I can't get it here. I need it. They still don't have sweet and sour sauce here, which just drives me insane. The other hard thing was
right.
the lack of diverse foods in Japan in general.
Really?
So you know, both of us are from Toronto, right? Toronto's a really rich multicultural
yep.
center. You got Little Italy, you got the Danforth, you got tons of Indian places, you got tons of Portuguese places,
yeah.
Lots of like Caribbean, Jamaican stuff.
You name it.
So that's, you know, you name it, you can get it, right?
Exactly.
In Japan, it's much scarcer. So Japan does European food really well. They do like, you know, Italian, French.
I've heard. Well. I've heard. Yeah. Apparently, a lot of people said the best pizza in the world now is in Japan.
Yeah, best Italian pizza is in Japan, is in Tokyo, right?
Wow.
And but for me, growing up, you know, downtown Toronto, you know, I was in love with the Caribbean food, and I was in love with Indian food, like, you know, roti and stuff like that.
Of course.
And you probably know I'm sure you've taken TTC more than a couple of times in your life. I love Jamaican patties.
Oh my God! Come on, please.
And they don't have them in Japan. There's no one who makes them.
Oh no!
So, you know, going from, you know, and I used to go to Ryerson for university. So okay. I was commuting from, you know, just from, you know, Bathurst King Queen up to Eaton Center every day for school. So I just, you know, stop by Bathurst Station, get a Jamaican patty, and go to right. school, right? I can't do that anymore. I don't have Jamaican patties. It's like one of the worst things. Like, I didn't even realize it, how much I missed it until like it was gone. I couldn't have it. I couldn't get it anymore. Right.
How crazy is that?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, the whole food thing is a thing, but you know, just the diversity of, you know, just culture, like it's gotten a lot better over the past 20 years. So, I found this guy in Yokohama that actually cooks Jamaican patties and sells them like, you know, across Japan, which is awesome. Okay, so now I can order it online.
Right.
But his costs like $6 per patty. Oof. And I'm like, yo, that's a little bit expensive. But he's a private business owner, whatever, right. Just starting up. So it's like, okay, you know, I get it. So I'm not gonna make a fuss. He's the only guy who does it. So he's got the market cornered. He can charge whatever he wants to.
Exactly right. That's hilarious. Yeah, because that's my, because again, I'm the same thing, just like you. I'm very not picky, but I like diverse food, right? So I like what I like, and that's the whole reason why I'm scared to go to Japan, is because of not having some place to eat. And so now that I know that you pretty much have the same palate as I do, what do you divulge in, and what are some of your favorite dishes or places to go to eat in Japan?
So I don't delve into Japanese food all that much, and that's mainly because like I actually cook Japanese food at home.
Oh, okay.
So, like, So, like, I learned how to cook, you know, traditional Japanese food. Like,
sure.
And, you know, people think, like, okay, sushi and, you know, ramen and stuff like that. That's not the typical. That's actually not really the traditional Japanese food. The real traditional Japanese food is, like, Japanese curry, you know, rice with, like, miso soup or something like that. And I learned how I learned the basics of that. And, you know, I do that. So when I go out, I go to, you know, there are actually a lot of Indian places around Japan now. So I always hit up, like, I always go out for Indian food. There's a lot of, like, obviously there are a lot of Chinese restaurants around, just like in Toronto, which is great. So that's one thing I don't really miss about Toronto, because Chinese food is pretty much the same here. So that's all good.
There you go.
But yeah, like I just try to get out and just have something that's like a little bit more diverse, just to keep up, you know, keep my palate. In a certain configuration, you know?
No, that's so cool to hear. And another big thing that's in Japan that we both enjoy is professional wrestling. Please tell me you've gone to a live show, my friend.
I've gone to plenty. I haven't been to Wrestle Kingdom, because Wrestle Kingdom's in Tokyo. I'm in Osaka.
Okay.
And
right.
Wrestle Kingdom, it's during the New Year.
I know, right?
So this is a funny thing. So, like, Christmas in Japan is more about romance and couples and doing your stuff with, you know, the people that you love. But, you know, Christmas in Canada is about family.
Family,
but
exactly.
It's different. It's different because New Year's in Japan is about the family, but, you know, New Year's in Canada is more about, you know, just going out and partying, having drinks and stuff like that. So I haven't been to Wrestle Kingdom yet, but I have been to the Osaka shows. So New Japan Pro Wrestling Dominion shows in Osaka.
Oh, those are also good. So.
Those are awesome. So yeah, I saw the first 60-minute match with Okada versus Omega.
Oh, nice!
And then I saw the rematch, the 2 out of 3 pinfalls,
right?
Where Omega won the title. I watched that live.
There you go.
Which is amazing. I've been to a bunch of Stardom shows as well. So
nice.
This was also starting 10 years back. I saw like. Io Sky and, you know, Kairi Sane.
Sure, of course.
I saw them when they were just starting off. And also Toni Storm was there as well.
Nice.
And then recently, like, I think the last show I went to was last year. And so I saw Shuri and I saw Julia. And I saw all those, all the new faces that started coming up. Which is amazing. Like, wrestling in Japan is awesome. It's so fun to watch.
Oh, I could only imagine. And again, two of my favorite things are embedded in Japanese history and current Japanese pop culture is video games and wrestling. That's another reason why I need to get over to Japan at least once in my lifetime. But what do you enjoy more, Japanese wrestling or North American wrestling?
That's a tough question.
Right?
That's a tough question because I grew up on WWE.
Of course, being from Toronto.
So the kind of wrestling they offer is really different from the wrestling that you get in Japan.
Okay.
And I feel like that if you're going to watch it on TV, then probably like New Japan might be like the Japanese wrestling might be a little bit better because the way they present it is more like a sport.
Yes.
Competition.
Exactly.
So they have a very like sports like presentation to their matches. So it feels very authentic. Whereas like, you know, with the WWE, you want to go to the show because of all the lights, the smoke, the special effects.
Right.
You know, so very much larger than life. So I like them for different reasons. If you know, if I'm gonna like, you know, really get hardcore into it, I might lean more to the Japanese side.
Okay.
Recently, after I got into the scene more.
Sure.
But I'm still a very huge fan of, WWE style or AEW style wrestling.
No, of course. And well, speaking of WWE, WrestleMania, depending on when the listeners are listening to this, is either just around the corner or it just happened. So Andrew and myself are going to run down some of our favorite WrestleMania moments of all time and see how many we could cram in here to fill the full hour. So I'll let you start off first, my friend. I usually do top fives, but we'll see how far we could get. So what's one of your favorite top WrestleMania moments of all time?
My number one favorite match of all time was at WrestleMania, WrestleMania 13.
Okay.
Hart versus Austin.
I agree. That's top five of mine too. Yes,
that's for me. That's the number one match of all time.
Wow,
I can watch that. Like I pretty much watch that every year because I love really? That. I love that match. It is so good. It's like it feels so authentic.
It does. Like, it does.
It feels like they, because everyone knows wrestling is scripted and blah 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 whatever.
Right.
But you kind of feel like these two hate each other in that match.
Right.
Like they cannot stand each other, and they want to win. Right. There's no flamboyance. There's no pomp. You know, pomp and posing whatever. They're just going at it, and it's amazing. And then the finish, where best. Austin passes out. He doesn't say I quit. They do the double turn. That's just like it's just magic. That's probably my number one.
And it's WrestleMania. And it's crazy because everyone always gives Bret Hart his flowers for being a technician, but I think his psychology is one of the best. And the way he acted and the way you could feel through this man, how much he either hated someone or loved someone. And it was like, oh my God, like he was so good at that, but he was so good at being a technician that it overshadows all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
You always think because of how he presents himself, excellence of execution.
Right.
You know, he's the technical specialist, but when you get down to it, when he has to, he goes to a different place, and he goes to that different place in this awesome match where he doesn't do things in the normal way. Sometimes he kind of goes a little bit off course with his character, gets a little bit meaner, just gets very nasty. And that's why I think that's what I like about that match. So it just feels very like authentic to me.
And like you said, it was very grimy. And I love that era of WWE. It was just after the cartoonish era, pretty much pre-Attitude, right before The Rock got his ascension and all that in DX. And the three top guys were Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and Austin. And oh my God, anything those three ever did together was golden. And I so loved that era of WWE.
I think I personally like it more than the Attitude Era, to be honest with you, because I think the Attitude Era, it has moments, great moments, right?
Of course.
But it kind of went a little bit goofy sometimes. Oh. And it's like, why are you guys? But, you had a... And, I love The Undertaker, but, the Ministry of Darkness and all that, that whole storyline, I'm just like, this is a little bit kind of weird.
Right.
You're going to a place where maybe you shouldn't be going in with,
But that was the thing back then. But hey, what can you do? Well, speaking of Undertaker, I'll throw in that as one of my memorable moments. Just the whole streak, because he had so many great matches, and it's so hard to pull which one was the greatest. Obviously, his first ones, again, that was during the gimmick era. Who could ever forget his match against Giant Gonzalez? One of my favorite. Yeah. Okay, but still, it's like the later stuff, like the Triple H matches, the Shawn Michaels matches, like, stuff like that. Even the one with CM Punk was good in its own right. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think the one with Edge, too, that was a fantastic match. I think that was really good because, everyone thought that, Edge would get his comeuppance, but he, Edge really took it to The Undertaker in that match, too. I thought it was fantastic. As far as like, The Undertaker goes, like, my personal favorite for his WrestleMania streak, I'm a huge fan of him versus Kane the first time
they met. Right.
Because that had a really good build-up.
It did.
Because, Kane came out of nowhere. You could see how scared The Undertaker was.
Right.
He sold it very well. Then they had the match, and you could see very clearly that Kane was taller than The Undertaker. And you're like, oh my God, he has the same moveset. He's bigger. He's stronger. What the fuck's going to happen?
Right.
And then at the end, the finish was one tombstone was enough, two was enough. They had to take three to put down Kane. And he still got the shoulder up at like 3.2 seconds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was a very nice touch because that showed like three was barely enough to put him away, but that's all the Undertaker could have, could muster out at that time. So I thought that was a good match as well. That's probably my favorite Undertaker match.
Now nitpicking, do you think Brock should have broke the streak?
Now that how things have played out, I think that was a right call. But at the time I didn't think it was really necessary. I thought that it would have been better if it was someone who could have benefited from it more. Because, you know, like, you know, Bray Wyatt would have benefited from it a lot more, I think.
I think
it would
so,
have,
yeah.
It would have, I think that would have elevated him a lot better. And, you know, and just all the transformations he had, I think it's because he wasn't picked for that moment. So he was kind of forced to, you know, do all those, you know, experimental matches and, you know, gimmicks and stuff like that. So I thought that was, you know, something. I think, you know, if they really wanted to, I would have thought that maybe they could have gave it to probably someone like, even like Roman might have been an idea just to establish him. Sure. I know that he did beat The Undertaker afterwards to, you know, kind of like, you know, kind of write him off for good, so to speak.
Right.
From the Federation. But, it might have been something that, you know, it just comes out of nowhere and then it kind of like just puts a rocket on him, strap a rocket on him and, you know, elevate him. So that could have been something too. But I think, I guess during that era, there might not have been anyone else other than those two that I would have chosen. Like I personally would have, you know, just left Undertaker, just have the streak intact and let him retire. With
right.
That,
yes.
That would have been better. I think that would have been the legacy.
I think so too. Thank you.
But then, you know, you always risk the, risk, you know, for the Undertaker, and he's, you know, said this, you know, recently, like he always gets the itch to come back and to wrestle that one last match. And, you know, if the streak is intact, then, you know, and he wants a match at WrestleMania, then you're going to have to, like, figure out a way to have him win, but not make it look like, you know, not bury the other person as well, right? So, you know, I guess, yeah, in hindsight, it was probably a good idea, but, you know, at the time, I was like, I don't really think Brock's gigantic. He's like, he's scary enough as it is. He doesn't really need, you know, that kind of push with beating the streak, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. Well put, obviously. All right, what's your next favorite WrestleMania moment, my friend?
Next one. This is a personal one because I actually I was able to WrestleMania 18. I went there, which was awesome. And I have to give shout-outs because I was actually writing for IGN at the time. And THQ, they were making the WWE games. They gave me and some other press people tickets to watch the show. So I got to watch Rock and Hogan live, which is amazing. That match was great. That match was obviously not the most technical of matches, but it was just a wild match. And I loved it. And I think overall, the whole card for that for WrestleMania 18 was actually pretty good because you had I remember Austin was fighting the NWO at that time.
Yes.
So you had Hall and Nash, you know,
yep.
There. I think Undertaker was fighting Ric Flair as well. And I think Jericho and Triple H were also fighting. So it was a pretty good match. A pretty good card. But you know, just being in Toronto and, you know, being a Toronto boy, like, you know, that was special to me because it's coming home here, you know, it's great.
And now, again, not to blow your mind, but the funny thing is I was also there at that event watching it live in the audience. And this is my favorite WrestleMania moment because of that too, because I was there. So how cool is that?
Well, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny because that and also WrestleMania 6. I didn't go to that because I was too young.
Yeah, me neither.
But those two WrestleManias are like probably my number one, number two, just because they're in Toronto, and you know the card was great, but it's also because, you know, the memories of,
yes, you feel,
you know,
it
doing something with the show, you know. So you know, I got to go to WrestleMania, you know, 18 live. I didn't go to 6, but I remember being in Eaton Center with my grandfather.
Okay.
And they were actually showing WrestleMania 6 on one of the display TVs.
Oh, nice.
In Eaton. And so me and my grandfather, crazy, just watching there. Everyone is gathered around the TV.
Wow.
All the TVs. And we're just watching. And it was like just one of those things. Like it's just stuck in my mind. Like, that's like an amazing memory I had with my grandfather, you know. So that's why I kind of like hold that event, like, you know, dear to my heart. But also, like, you know, that was Hogan versus Ultimate Warrior, which is, you know, another, not the best technical match, but also just had an amazing build-up, lots of great drama. So I still love that match, too.
No kidding. And it's funny because it was literally like a decade later that we had Hogan versus Rock. And it was sort of, again, not him giving the torch, but sort of like the old guard versus the new guard. And we totally flipped everything backwards because we started cheering for the wrong guy. And then just that stare down at the beginning, like that's my favorite moment of all time. Again, because again, I was there live and we were a part of the fans in the audience screaming and yelling. And it was so fantastic. And like, I totally, because I haven't gone back and literally watched that WrestleMania since I've been there live. So it was hard, like, it's hard for me to remember a lot of the other stuff that happened because that moment is so etched in my memory. And it was so funny because I've had Jazz on the show and she wrestled on that night versus Trish Stratus and I totally forgot.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's just one of those things where, you know, it just has, the event has a bigger impact on your life than you kind of like, you know.
Right.
You realize until you look back and be like, oh my God, you know, that actually happened. And You don't remember the details, but you remember like the emotion that you felt during that match. And I remember that stare down, Hogan and Rock.
So good.
And everyone around me was cheering for Hogan. I'm like, what are you guys doing? He's the heel. And I'm like, this is a typical Toronto crowd.
Right.
Typical Toronto will always do the exact opposite of what every other crowd does without fail. And it's just the most hilarious thing. And I got into it too. So I started cheering for Hogan too because I didn't want to get beat up because, you know, I was in the crowd too. I didn't want to cheer for The Rock, even though I loved The Rock at the time. But, peer pressure and all that stuff. But it was a fantastic moment, you know?
No, it was. And then on to my next moment, which, again, being nostalgic, is probably the reason why I got into watching wrestling was the WrestleMania 4 tournament. Good. Yeah. Like, I used to hate, and I've told this story before in the past on the show, where my older brothers used to watch it and it would scare the shit out of me, from age maybe like 6 and under. And then my cousin rented WrestleMania 4 VHS double tape and we watched it and I was like, what is, like, I don't know, just the pomp and circumstance, maybe because it was the first WrestleMania that felt like huge. Well, WrestleMania 3 was huge. But I don't know, it felt still like ghetto, in my opinion. I don't know if that makes sense. Whereas 4 was more, like, there was more music already. Everyone had an entrance theme. Like, everyone was more, I don't know. It just felt more geared towards kids, where I think 3 and under, they were still trying to gear towards adults.
Yeah. I think 1, 2, and 3, they were, like, they were special because they were just starting. They were trying to figure out, like, you know, what can we do to make this bigger, better, you know? And then with WrestleMania 4, they kind of figured it out from that time, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I can totally understand that. Then, and I think now that you mentioned it, WrestleMania 4 was actually I did like that event too. Like, I haven't watched it in a long time. I remember watching like the first 4 in a row like a couple of years ago.
Okay.
And just kind of like just watching it just because I wanted to get ready for the next WrestleMania. I think it's also because I think maybe for me, I was too young to really understand what was going on. So everything was kind of like a little bit scarier, right?
Of course.
You didn't really know if they were really hurting each other and everything.
Exactly. So,
with Andre and Hogan, you didn't really know, you look at Andre, you're like, oh my God, what the hell's happening? Then you see Hogan trying to lift up Andre. He doesn't do it the first time. And you're like,
right.
See, whoa, how can he lift up this guy and then he does it? He finally does it, right? And you're just cheering because I'm a kid. I don't know any better.
Exactly.
I didn't know he was, that was part of the whole, selling part of the industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of funny looking back on those WrestleManias because that's when I was just a kid, didn't really know better.
Exactly.
And then I think during like maybe WrestleMania 9 or 10, that's when I kind of like understood like, oh wait, this is all scripted. It's like, it's more like a fight in a martial arts movie kind of thing. So just take it like that. I totally agree with you. I think that WrestleMania was also, pretty awesome.
And it was, again, the rise of Macho Man, and that's what literally took him off, because again, what he did with Steamboat at WrestleMania 3 pretty much catapulted him into this position. And to finally see Hogan step down from being the champ for so long, because he had that streak that now Roman is pretty much chasing, right?
Yep. Exactly. I think it's kind of funny, like, how just the whole wrestling industry, it just comes in ways. It's a full circle a lot of times, right?
Of course.
They repeat a lot of the same sort of lines, put their own little twists to it. I'm a huge fan of, like, you know, what Roman is doing right now, because I think that storyline is amazing.
Of course.
But it does have, you know, the roots of it are from, like, past events in wrestling. So it's kind of awesome to see how they take those foundations and, like, kind of build on it to make it something a little bit more unique to the character and all that.
And it's funny that you say that, because I think it's mirroring almost the rise of Daniel Bryan defeating the Authority at WrestleMania 30 compared to what Cody is doing now.
Yeah.
Right? And it's 10 years later.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's exactly, I think you're on the right track there. Like, I remember, like, it was Batista, right? The Batista won the Royal Rumble.
The Rumble,
and
then yeah.
He was supposed to be in the match, yeah. And, yeah, I remember, like, you know, by that time, I get, like, the parallel between Authority and the Bloodline. It's kind of like, they kind of have, like, the same kind of, like, they share some DNA there, for sure.
Exactly.
Where they're kind of, like, they're locking people out. I do like that they're not, you know, now they have, like, you know, the SmackDown and Raw GMs. They make sure that the Bloodline is firmly under them, right? And there's no, like,
I like that.
You know, they can't control everything. Because now there's that whole line that, okay, they may control, like, when and where they fight, but they can't do it forever. And they have to still kind of, like, you know, play their little games to make sure that they get the result they want. Because they can't, like, have full authority over everything, like, with the Authority had, like, pre-Bloodline with, you know, Triple H and, you know, Stephanie McMahon and all, you know, their whole crew.
Yeah, and I think they've learned their lesson from watching what the NWO did, and pretty much, you mentioned it, the corporate ministry. Like, so it's like, you can't let these factions go too crazy, because then how are you going to reel them back, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think they do a good job, because they have Paul Heyman there as part of the Bloodline. He's like the brains. He's been around for such a long time that he knows how to manipulate everyone and get what he wants. But he's also not infallible, right? He gets tricked sometimes. He gets you know, the wool pulled over his eyes, and he gets, you know, placed into bad situations that make, you know, Roman and his crew mad at everyone else, kind of thing. So I think it's a very, like, they definitely learned how to, like, be a little bit more intricate with their details, and kind of, like, they're taking a lot of, like, notes from just traditional TV and storylines, and kind of adding those elements in there to make things a lot more appealing to people. Because now people are actually paying attention to all the little details that everyone is doing, with all the promos and their matches and stuff like that. Because, you know, when The Rock came back and they're doing their whole signature pose, or the one pose, right? And now you see everyone's, like, pointing out, why is Rock doing L finger with his now they got everyone, like, hook, line, and sinker, because now everyone's looking for details in the story to try to figure things out, which I think is very smart.
Well, it is, and I think that's what I love personally about the Attitude Era, was how everything intermingled, like, every storyline intermingled, whereas something was happening in a backstage, then they cut and someone's walking by, and you sort of see that again, where it's not just your mundane person in the background, okay, what's going on in your next match, with a microphone in their face. Like, when you see someone in the back now, someone's walking in the background, it's like, oh, that means something. Why did that person just walk in there? Because, you know, WWE does not make those mistakes, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's what they started doing with NXT, like, you know, several years back, right?
Exactly.
When Triple H was still producing that show, and he was doing all that kind of stuff, and it was really good. And now that he's in charge of the main shows, now he's bringing all that back into the main shows, and giving everything a much richer, you know,
love it,
layer of detail, which I think all the fans really appreciate, for sure.
No doubt. All right, Andrew, give me another one, my friend.
Let's see here. I'm a big fan of the TLC matches. I forget which one, which WrestleMania it is, though.
I believe it's WrestleMania 17. If it's, you're talking about Hardy's, Dudley's, and Edge and Christian?
Yes.
Seven, where he takes that, the spear off the. Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yes, that match. I'm usually a fan of more the technical matches, competitive style matches. Because Bret Hart is my favorite wrestler of all time.
Oh, beautiful.
Austin is number two, because Austin, even though he's known as a brawler, early in his career he was very technical. Yep. He was extremely good at his job, right? But on the other side of the spectrum, having the Hardys, the Dudleys, and Edge and Christian going absolute bananas with their TLC matches was just crazy, right? And just seeing the stuff that they do and how they do it, it's just like they plan their spots so well, and it seems like so natural how they do it, timing and everything. And it's kind of like I don't want to rag on people current wrestlers, but sometimes I watch certain matches nowadays, and a lot of spots seem very, very planned out, and you can tell it's planned out because
you see it coming.
There's a lot of waiting time.
Yeah,
they do the step up to the top rope. They balance themselves, and then you have a crowd of people waiting for them,
just looking up. I agree.
Looking up, I'm you could do something a little bit more with that, right? I wish that they could even just pretend that you're fighting in the crowd.
Sure.
You don't see the guy coming to the top, and just let him jump on top of you guys and break his fall or something like that. That would be better, right? And with TLC matches, you could tell that they obviously it hurts. It looks like it hurts. It must hurt, but they had their timing down super, super well in those matches. That's another one that I love.
Yeah, but see, I was the same like you. I first started off as a technical, loving technical wrestling, like Bret Hart, same thing with you. But I was more of a Shawn Michaels fan. I just liked the heel factor of Shawn Michaels. Piece of shit Shawn Michaels is the best heel on earth to me, in my opinion. I just loved that as a kid. He did it so well. And then growing up, when I first saw ECW pop up in Toronto, I was like, what is this? I fell in love with hardcore wrestling. And then obviously it was too much. It's like, okay, I gotta reel myself down. This isn't wrestling in the end. I don't need to see every match have blood and steel chairs in it. You know what I mean? So these TLC matches are great. And at the time, I think WWE did it pretty well, where they introduced these sort of hardcore and TLC and whatnot matches to offset not to show the bad work rate, as they say, that there was in the Attitude Era. Mm.
Yeah, for sure. I think I think you have make a good point about just the work rate sometimes. The quality of wrestling right now is just
so good.
It's so good, right?
Oh, so and good.
Sometimes I feel that's why some of the spots I'm just looking at them, I'm like, yeah, I know you guys are trying to, make sure everyone's safe. I know that you don't want to take too many. You want to do this spot, and you want to do it a certain way. But there are some little things that I feel that it could do just to make it come off a little bit more authentic, right? And this is not only for, this happens in WWE, it happens in AEW as well. And it's mainly with the mid-card, lower card or mid-card wrestlers matches that it happens. With the upper card and the main event, they know what they're doing. They have their timing down pat. But I pretty much agree with you on that. Yeah,
it's crazy. Okay, and to end it off, so we could call it a night here, my friend. I'll throw in Razor versus Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 10 in the IC title in the ladder match.
Yeah.
That is, again, looking back, it's not the greatest ladder match of all time. But again, the story building and me being a Shawn Michaels fan. And at the time, Razor was pretty much my number two guy as well. And it's like to see these two cool heels go at it, because that was when Shawn was about to turn to go face. And it was like, oh, this is so great. And I loved it from start to finish. Everything about that match.
Yeah, that match, I think that match was amazing. Looking back, I remember watching that on pay-per-view with my cousins. And that was a crazy match. That was the first ladder match too, right? I think.
I think either first televised or pay-per-viewed, because I think Bret Hart had one, supposedly at a house show or something beforehand. And then that's where they got the idea to do that one. But yeah, that was the first major one that was on TV. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, yeah. And I remember like, you know, like watching that, I was thinking, like, what are they doing with the ladder? Like, how can you use a ladder to do anything other than, you know, grab the belt? And they just started doing all this crazy stuff, like just throwing at each other, jumping off of it. And I was like, yeah, it definitely opened my eyes to, like, you know, the possibility of, like, you know, those kind of like gimmick matches where they're using the different options and whatnot. It's more like, it's not about getting the pin, it's about doing something else. And, you know, that was one of those matches that I do look fondly back on, because it's like, I think it's, to me, it's one of those matches where I feel like that's where, like, sometimes I feel like sometimes some of the giving matches are going a little bit too crazy at times,
yeah.
Especially now.
Or too much is going on at once, I find.
Yeah, too much is going on at once.
Yeah.
And with the ladder match, it's just a ladder. And they might have some backup ladders, but it's just a very simple in concept. But it allows for more innovation, I think, because of that. Because they have something, but it's a little bit extra, but it's not too extra, right? So exactly. they can be a little bit more creative with things.
No, and for sure. And again, the whole two title belt thing storyline, again, that was like, I think that was, yeah, that was, was that before or after Ric Flair showed up with his belt? Before, right?
I think it might have been before, yeah, a little bit before.
So, yeah, so I think that was the first time where it was like two belts disputed for something. And it was like, oh, again, that blew my mind as a kid watching that whole thing. It's like, oh, it's true. So he is the true champ, but Razor won it fairly. But who is the champ? Like, you know what I mean? It was so good, so good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was a great storyline. I do wish they kind of like do that a little bit more often these days, because nowadays, you know, when they write someone off, they haven't dropped the belt or they vacate it or something. It'd be great if they, and then, you know, when they come back, you know, even with they did, you know, CM Punk did it with, you know, recently in AEW.
Where yes, says, they tried.
You know,
yep.
I was injured. I'm coming back for the belt. It's my belt now, right? You know, he did it. He did it in a way where I thought it was a little bit more valid instead of just vacating it.
Right.
You know, just say, like, you know, just say you never lost it. So, and then, you know, have your own version of the belt and, you know, make it something cool like that instead of just, you know, kind of writing that wrestler off for however long. To me, it's a more compelling storyline.
See, I think that's, again, being Monday morning quarterback. It's like, okay, I love what they do with two world titles. I understand why they do it. But like you said, I think there should be one world title. And then maybe someone goes out on injury. And then after he comes back, and now we have two world titles. And that one person defends it a few times. And then after we merge it after a few months. So there's an always two titles, if that makes sense.
Yeah, 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 for sure. That totally makes sense to me, yeah.
And I would love that so much. Oh, my God. Okay, one last thing before we call it a show. Again, video games, wrestling. What are some of your favorite wrestling games? But not just any wrestling games, non-WWE wrestling games.
Okay. Now, this one's easy. My favorite wrestling game of all time is Saturday Night Slam Masters. It's on a Super Nintendo.
Really?
It's an arcade game. It's basically a cross between a wrestling game and a fighting game, like Street Fighter style fighting game.
Okay.
And, you know, you have, from Final Fight, you have, like, you know, Mike Hagar is in the game.
Oh, shit.
And he's like Zangief. He does a lariat. He does a spinning pile driver.
Okay.
They got someone who looks like the Great Muta in the game.
Oh, wow.
They got someone who looks like Rey Mysterio in the game.
Nice.
It's a really fun take on wrestling and fighting because they kind of merge the two elements together, and the character designs are made by the same guy who created the Fist of the North Star manga. So
okay,
he's got some wild designs. So I like that.
Is it still playable though? That's my question. Because
it's still very playable. Yeah. Because
some of those old school NES, Super NES wrestling games, it's hard because it's so clunky, and you just don't know the moves as well, right?
I think the great thing about this game is that you do have your grapple moves, so you can grapple someone,
okay. Do
suplexes, body slams, you can do Irish whips and stuff like that. But it has traditional, like, Street Fighter special moves too. So you can do, if you know how to do a fireball, you know, Hadouken,
sure.
Then you can do special moves, right?
Oh, gotcha.
So it's got a real cool mix, I think. That's by far my number one favorite fighting game. Wrestling game. That's non-WWE.
Yeah, I'll throw in, obviously, you got to go with Fire Pro because, you know, who doesn't like that one? Because that's, especially with the New Japan add-ons and all that fun stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to throw a more obscure one, not only because I have one of the creators on, but Retro Mania Wrestling. I don't know if you've heard of this, Andrew. This is a fantastic homage to the old WWE WrestleFest game.
Yep.
But it has old school wrestlers, new wrestlers, guys from the NWA. Like, it has like all kinds of guys like from all the federations. And it's like, oh, it's so great. The only knock on it that people are saying is the storyline is a little bit too short. So the career is like very short because you play as Johnny Retro or Johnny Nitro, who Johnny Wrestling, however you want to name him. But in the game, he's called Johnny Retro. And you play his story, and oh, it's so good, but it's too short. I just want more. That's my only complaint about the thing. But again, it's a fantastic game. If you haven't checked it out, I highly recommend it.
Okay, I think I'm pretty sure I saw that on the Switch.
Yeah, it's available on the Switch. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll give it a check. I'll give it a look for sure.
Thank you for coming aboard, my friend. It's been an honor. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Wrestling, video games, all that fun stuff. If you want to promote anything, your socials, floor's all yours, my friend.
Okay, I don't have too much socials to promote because I'm not on social all that much anymore. Just I'm kind of like browsing the chaos, and I'm trying not to get involved in the chaos too much.
I'm the same, my friend. Don't worry.
Yeah, you can search for me on I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky as well. If you just search my name, I'm very easy to find. It was great to be here on your show. Just to be able to talk wrestling just like this because I love wrestling. I love video games, so this is a fantastic, fantastic time.
Oh, thanks, my friend. And for myself, you can find me on Instagram and X under Finga Styles. You can follow the podcast on X, the podcast app. Email us your thoughts, suggestions, comments, anything you want to get off your chest at thepodcastapp@gmail.com. Check out those fine sponsors, because if it helps them out, most definitely helps me out. Most importantly, please rate, subscribe, review on all the major platforms. And if this is the first time listening to the show, please go back and listen to other video game creators and people who have worked on video games, such as Mike Micah, Stephen Frost, Howard Scott Warsaw, and Josh Sway, to name just a few. All right, Andrew, one last question before I let you go, my friend.
Okay.
If you could only choose one publisher's library to play for the rest of your life, which one would you choose?
Oh, that's rough. Oh, my God. Okay. Man, let me give this a thing. Hold on for a second. Either gotta be Nintendo or Capcom, I guess. Nintendo or Capcom. I'm not too sure. Depends on my mood.
And don't worry, I'm right there with you. I have Ubisoft and Nintendo, but my special shoutouts would be for old school games, especially Capcom and Konami.
Yeah, for sure. Like, it's looking at the whole history, like the 40-year history of the game industry. Like, Nintendo is just has been consistent.
So good,
like, amazing. Yes, Capcom has been there too. Square Enix has been there too. Like, I would have to say if I'm looking for something that's, you know, just fun, carefree, Nintendo for sure
has to be.
That's
right.
My number one. If I'm looking for something that I want to like really like sink my teeth into, just like almost like training, you know, getting my skills up, then probably Capcom, but yeah.
Awesome. On that note, he's Andrew. I'm Steve. This is the podcast. Peace.